and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Gas and food prices are still going up. What's causing that, and what does it say about the rest of the economy? Takeaways from President Trump's visit to China.
In 1986, there were only about a dozen piping plover pairs left in the Great Lakes.
And piping plover eggs are spotted at Montrose Beach and in Waukegan. We explain what their presence means for conservation efforts. First off tonight, Alderperson Jesse Fuentes is suing the federal government over an incident with two federal agents. The case stems from last fall during the Department of Homeland Security's Operation Midway Blitz, when immigration agents handcuffed and detained her. The 26th Ward Alderperson says she was advocating for a hospitalized constituent who was in ICE custody at the time and claims agents physically shoved and threatened her. Fuentes was released outside the hospital. We have more of this story on our website. Chicago's 45th Ward Alderman Jim Gardner says his lawsuit against the city is about transparency and accountability. He's accusing the city, its Board of Ethics, and now former Inspector General of allegedly conspiring to charge him with an ethics violation and drive him out of office.
This is about the hearing officer being asked by the city if he could make his decision private, all while leading up to the case, they made this public. This is about transparency and accountability, and to be frank, what price can you put on that? What price can you put on your reputation?
Gardner says the city and inspector general suppressed evidence and used false testimony in an investigation that found Gardner used his position as alderman to retaliate against a neighbor who'd been critical of him. That Board of Ethics ruling was later overturned. The far northwest side alderman is asking a jury to award him at least $1 million in damages. The Chicago Law Department declined to comment on the lawsuit, saying it has not yet been served and doesn't comment on pending litigation. Northwestern University's next president will make university history as its first Asian American president. The school's Board of Trustees today announced that Meng Chiang will become the university's 18th leader. Chiang has been at the helm of Purdue University since 2023, where he's credited with expanding researching activity to more than $1 billion, creating industry partnerships, and advancing major initiatives in tech, health, and business. He starts his new gig on July 1st. Up next, what's driving rising gas and food prices? That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Travelers are preparing to hit the road for the upcoming Memorial Day weekend, and their wallets may take a hit too. Gas prices in Chicago are up 70 cents from a month ago and nearly $1.70 compared to last year. Meanwhile, inflation is up and disruptions to fertilizer shipments are leading to uncertainty in the agriculture business. Joining us are Ken Foster, professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University, and Sam Ori, executive director of the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. Thanks to you both for joining us. Sam Ori, how has the war in Iran affected oil and gas prices?
Well, this is the biggest disruption in the history of the oil market, so it's pretty significant. The global oil market is about 100 million barrel a day oil market. You have about 20 million barrels a day or so going through the Strait of Hormuz. So there's really nothing that compares to this. The oil market is down something on the order of 1.2 billion barrels over the course of the crisis. And so this has led to a massive increase in oil prices already, from about $60 a barrel before the crisis to now today around $110 a barrel. So it's been a pretty significant impact.
On that, Sam, can you explain how oil markets settle on a global price?
It's supply and demand. It's a global market. It's the sum total of all of the supplies that go into the market on any day, and demand, and the cost of drilling the next well to meet demand. And so It's really one of the most fluid, one of the most liquid markets in the world, no pun intended. Huh. And, you know, I think a question that a lot of Americans have, I can imagine, and probably many Chicagoans, is, you know, given that the U.S. is such a massive producer and a massive exporter, why are prices so high here? And it really just speaks to the global nature of the oil market. Essentially, a disruption like this that happens anywhere in the world affects prices everywhere. The United States, although it is a massive producer and a massive exporter, is also an importer of oil. And these are just fundamentally global markets. And so the price that gets set in the world market is the price that essentially, you know, short of or adjusted for location and for shipping costs, is the price that we pay here in the U.S.
Ken Foster, how is the Strait of Hormuz closure affecting farmers?
Well, I think it's broadly separate depending on where you are in the United States. If you're a Midwestern farmer, most Midwestern farmers secured their fertilizer prior to the conflict and in some cases even applied it last fall. And so those fertilizer prices aren't the prices that they're paying. If you go to the South, it's a little different. The culture there is a little different. And so some Southern farmers would not have purchased their fertilizer for this year's crop. And of course, they're facing these higher prices for fertilizer. At the same time, the conflict arose right at the beginning of planting season. So most of the plans were in place, and there's been very little disruption to farmers' plans for the 26 season. I think, you know, the thing to watch is the duration of this conflict. And if it goes on into the fall and starts to affect the 27 crop planting season, then I think we're going to see some changes in how crops are grown, where they're grown, and which crops are focused on by farmers as they make adjustments and try to avoid high fertilizer prices.
Then it sounds like you're saying the oil price shocks that we're seeing right now might not be directly impacting food prices.
Yeah, no, I mean, they are, or they will be, but not through that channel. So they're more likely to affect food prices through the energy portion of the retail food dollar, which is mostly around transportation, processing, and the cold chain, keeping things cold or frozen, not directly through farm prices or farm fertilizer prices.
Sam, if the Strait closure, the Strait of Hormuz, of course, if that closure continues on for another month or two, what then might we see happening to oil prices?
Well, I think you're going to see prices continue to go up. You're really starting to see in this market the kind of the buffers, the breaks on the market really start to erode. You know, one reason that prices haven't gone up as much as many people suspected or expected that they would at the beginning of the crisis is that the oil market was in a state of surplus. There was lots of inventory at sea. There was sanctioned Iranian barrels at sea, sanctioned Russian barrels at sea that bought the world several days of supply. There's lots of commercial inventories in the U.S. and other parts of the world that bought the world extra days of supply. But those inventories are starting to come down. And I think it's a real question of how quickly we get to a resolution of the crisis. You know, the most important thing to bring prices down is going to be opening up the Strait of Hormuz again. You know, even once the Strait opens, I think something that's important to understand is that it is going to take some time for the oil market to really re-equilibrate, for barrels to start flowing back through the Strait of Hormuz again. I think, you know, estimates range from 3 to 6 months. I'm hearing more and more that it will take up to 6 months for the oil market to stabilize and normalize. And so, you know, you're starting to see the forecast come out from places like Goldman Sachs and other oil market forecasting experts who are saying prices, even if the crisis were to resolve tomorrow, you're looking at prices, you know, close to $100 a barrel through the end of the year.
Ken, you know, if and when the Strait does reopen, how would you expect fertilizer prices to respond?
Yeah, fertilizers markets are very much like the oil market. It's a global market. It's very fluid. There will be some delays, matters of weeks, as new inputs surface to the United States and to Western Europe where they get turned into fertilizer. But we would expect it to stabilize in a relatively few weeks or months back to normal. So again, you know, the timing of the resolution is super important here, because if it gets resolved in time for farmers to begin making the 27 crop decisions based on lower fertilizer prices or the prospect of lower fertilizer prices between now and next spring, then it takes a lot of relief off of that channel in terms of retail food price inflation.
Sam, you mentioned, you know, prices not, you know, shooting quite as high as some people expected they might have when the conflict started. That said, we're at a little over $5 a gallon today, which I think that is enough for some folks. I think it's hard to imagine prices going much higher.
It is the point where we're starting to see some demand destruction. It's true. I mean, prices are up about 55% from before the crisis. It's costing the typical American household around an extra $100 a month in gasoline spending. So that's less money that's available for groceries or going to a baseball game or whatever it might be. But it is certainly the case that prices can go higher. If the crisis is not resolved soon, if this is dragging out into, you know, into June, and it's hard to imagine it dragging on beyond June into July, you know, there's not going to be enough of a buffer left. We really are drawing down the inventories at a historic pace. There's never been a drawdown in inventories like this, which is what you would expect to match this kind of historic crisis. So when we get to the point where there aren't those inventory, you know, inventories available as a buffer, and you really get into a shortage situation in the world market, prices will have to go higher to bring the market into equilibrium. And so you're missing 20 million barrels a day-ish of oil. It will have to, you know, the demand will have to go down to make demand and supply come into equilibrium, and that is going to require much higher prices. So the most important thing that can happen in terms of the oil market, I mean, this is obviously a foreign policy, this is a national security crisis, there's many other considerations, but from an oil market perspective, the most important thing that can happen is getting the strait back open and getting barrels flowing through the strait again.
Ken, we've got about 30 seconds, but what other policy decisions, short of reopening the Strait of Hormuz, might meaningfully impact the cost that farmers are paying?
Well, I think more than the cost side, we've seen some relaxation in terms of renewable fuels policy that are going to help farm prices in the future, in particular soybeans, because soybean oil is primary input into making biodiesel, and there's been quite a bit of opportunity to expand that market now based on new decisions that were made in Washington. So hopefully that'll give a little higher revenues to offset the increased costs.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. Sam Ori and Ken Foster, thanks to you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, details about President Trump's visit to Beijing. An exchange of niceties and kicking the can down the road. That's how analysts are describing last week's Beijing summit between President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping. While the two leaders reached some agreement on trade deals, questions still loom large over Taiwanese independence and which country will emerge as the dominant world power for decades to come. Joining us to break down the summit is Raymond Kuo, Vice President of Research for Geostrategy and Diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Raymond, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So break down the goals that each country had for this summit, please. What did China want? What did the U.S. want?
Sure. So on both sides, they were looking for some kind of economic engagement. The Chinese are facing a long-term economic malaise, and really they're trying to grow their way out of it using exports. Of course, in order to do that, you need access to the U.S. market. So the tariffs that we imposed on them, I think at the highest last year was 145%, somewhere around there, meant that they really couldn't access the market. On the U.S. side, we're obviously dealing with a host of economic issues right here, including oil prices because of the Iran war. And so finding ways to get cheaper goods, you know, there's hopefully an opportunity for a meeting of the minds where we can kind of de-escalate from the tariff wars that are going on and get back to doing business as usual.
Which country would you say accomplished more of its goals?
Probably China, unfortunately. I think the Chinese, well, starting with the United States, usually we coordinate these engagements through an interagency process where the State Department takes the lead, and then we'll get the Commerce Department, Treasury, DOD all on board saying these are our priorities in, you know, X, Y, and Z order. That really didn't happen. And in advance of the summit, we didn't have the mid-level bureaucrats going out there and kind of hacking away at the easy, low-hanging fruit. So instead, it was kind of a, you know, kind of a free-for-all. Everyone went over there all at once. Everyone was trying to advocate for their key positions. Whereas on the Chinese side, they did all that homework. They had a clear sense of priorities, knew what they wanted to ask for, and really also set the agenda by saying, Taiwan is going to be our top priority.
All right, let's talk about Taiwan, because of course that is a big, we knew that was a big point of discussion. Remind us of the geopolitical significance that Taiwan holds for the U.S.
Sure. So Taiwan is part of what we call the first island chain. This is, you know, goes from Japan, Taiwan, Philippines, all the way down. And it's really kind of the barrier that keeps China contained within its own region. Taiwan is a critical linchpin to that. General MacArthur called it an unsinkable aircraft carrier and submarine tender. And so it's a critical geostrategic node. Also, there's economics. About 90% of the most advanced semiconductors in the world are made in Taiwan itself. And so if you were to, if the Chinese were, for example, to capture Taiwan, they would have not only a strong geostrategic stronghold, but also possession of a really important critical commodity in global supply chains.
Where did the two countries land on Taiwanese independence? And how did that, like, how'd that conversation go?
Yeah, so I mean, the summit itself didn't seem to address that. It wasn't like there was a readout or a public statement. But Trump's interview with, I think, Brett Baer on Fox News after this, that's really where a lot of this came out. And unfortunately, it, at least in my view, Trump was parroting quite a lot of the Chinese government's talking points, saying that, look, it's really the Taiwanese that are causing problems in the strait, even though the Chinese have launched multiple military operations, soft blockades, you name it. And then, you know, I think perhaps the worst thing in my mind is that Trump reiterated his belief that that Taiwan had stolen the U.S. chip industry. Just not true at all. but that this was almost kind of retribution for saying, like, you should give it back to us, and maybe we'll consider defending you or supporting you.
What does that tell you? Does that signal sort of a shift in U.S. policy around Taiwan if the president is saying this?
Well, both Trump and Secretary of State Rubio, especially Rubio, mentioned a couple times that U.S. policy on Taiwan hasn't changed. Maybe. I mean, you know, technically that might be true, but we really have to see what happens with what Trump decides to do with the arms sales package. With the six assurances, some of these assurances we give to China as well as Taiwan, we said that we would not pre-clear or negotiate with the Chinese over arms sales to Taiwan. It seems like that may have actually occurred during this meeting, or that at the very least the Chinese have given the Trump administration a talking point to say, maybe we should hold off on some of these sales.
Leading up to the summit, experts expected the two leaders to discuss AI and access to advanced AI technologies, but readouts from both countries did not highlight AI as a central topic. Did they miss an opportunity here?
I don't know. I mean, I think there was an announcement that the U.S. has allowed 10 Chinese companies to purchase NVIDIA's second most advanced chip. Now, you know, Chinese AI models tend to work on efficiency as opposed to raw computing power. But even so, getting access to those chips will be a huge boon for those particular Chinese companies. The fact that Jensen Huang, I think, evidently flew from California or somewhere, met up with Air Force One in Alaska, you know, it strikes me that this was, one, an opportune moment for him, but two, it also means that it wasn't really coordinated in advance. Going back to that question about the interagency process and the kind of advanced work, if you're going to have a CEO of a company show up last minute on a trip, that means you haven't prepared the conversation with your counterparts in China.
The two countries have also been a little bit tight-lipped about any conversation around Iran. What do we know about what came out of those conversations about Iran?
So as far as I can tell, there was Chinese at least verbal support saying that, yes, we want to have the Strait of Hormuz reopened, we want to have peace in the Middle East, but at the same time, you know, generally speaking, I think the Chinese view this as, well, you broke it, you bought it, you have to fix this. In fact, you know, when I think about other countries in the region, for example, the Thai foreign minister was, I believe, in D.C. a couple of weeks back. He said, look, the U.S. hasn't offered us any support with the economic fallout of this. By contrast, the Chinese and the Russians have come to us and said, if you need support, we are willing to help. And it just kind of shifts of public opinion and government opinion in the region towards China and away from the United States.
Okay. Reports have also noted that Trump has been effusive in his praise of President Xi, while the Chinese leader did not seem to return that level of admiration. And we know that it is something that President Trump appreciates. And some have argued that contrast reflects a power imbalance, suggesting that Trump was seeking Xi's approval. Anything to that? Analysts reading into it?
You know, I don't like to do the armchair psychologizing. I'm personally not a trained in psychology. but I think there was a notable kind of point there. Yeah, I think to some extent, Trump seems to kind of acted a little bit off the cuff, right? Whereas Xi Jinping was much more disciplined about saying, you know, A, B, and C priorities. That it could just be a reflection of that, where you know the relative lack of preparation on the U.S. side meant that Trump was kind of filling the void with more happy talk, for example. Whereas you know Xi Jinping was like, nope, we've got A, B, and C issues we want to talk about. Let's go down the list, and we're going to kind of give you our positions and wait for you to respond.
Right, sticking to the business, which is also, I mean, a reflection of the two men's differences in style, right? We know the president likes to talk off the cuff. And say what he thinks.
That's exactly right.
Yes, yeah. Rather than sticking to the agenda sometimes or the teleprompter.
Exactly.
Okay, so despite the summit yielding some, you know, few concrete outcomes, both countries have portrayed the meeting itself as a success. Mm. Officials on both sides arguing that the talks helped reinforce stability in the relationship. Just yesterday, the White House in Beijing announced that President Xi will make a reciprocal visit to Washington in September. That's Does this right. summit mark a step towards, you know, a more stable U.S.-China relationship? What does all of this signal?
Well, I mean, I think it's not only the meeting in September, I think they're also supposed to meet twice more this year. So there's multiple opportunities for both President Trump and Xi Jinping to meet with each other. I am hesitant to say this would lead to long-term stability. One issue is kind of the credibility deficit we have here in the United States, on the U.S.'s side. You know, when Trump, for example, talks about our trade deals with Canada and Mexico being the worst he's ever seen, those were negotiated under his first term. And so if you're willing to stab your own kind of trade agreements in the back, how much can the Chinese trust that we'll actually commit to this long term?
Right. A relationship I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on. We'll have you back to discuss it again next time. Raymond Kuo, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, the story behind Plovermania. WTTW News explains right after this. If you've been in Chicago for the past 7 summers, you know that bird lovers and many others have gone plover crazy. That's because these rare, tiny shorebirds have, against all odds, been nesting at Montrose Beach. Well, Plovermania 2026 edition is ready to take flight. Maybe not take flight yet, because it is at least in its embryonic stages. Literally, plover eggs have been laid at Montrose Beach and in Waukegan. So what's all the fuss about? Our Patty Wetley explains.
Chicago's lakefront is famously open and free. So why is a prime section of Montrose Beach roped off every summer? Because it's for the birds, literally, the piping plovers. Piping plovers are tiny shorebirds about the size of a smartphone, but a fraction of the weight. There used to be a few thousand of them spread across the entire Great Lakes, but then people took away a lot of the beaches where they lived, building houses, hotels, marinas, and resorts. By 1986, there were only about a dozen piping plover pairs left in the Great Lakes, all of them nesting in Michigan. The future looked so bleak for our feathered friends, they were officially added to the endangered species list. Fast forward to 2019. Two of these rare creatures, a male and a female, turned up on Montrose Beach. Chicago's birders rejoiced. Huzzah! There hadn't been a nesting pair in Cook County since Harry Truman was president. But against all odds and logic, a pair of plovers had landed on one of the most crowded beaches in Chicago and decided to start a family. Amazing! Maybe a slightly unwise choice on the plovers' part, but amazing. An army of volunteers quickly formed to protect the plovers, who they named Monty and Rose, from beachgoers and other threats. Long story short, the couple, and eventually their chicks, spent the summer charming the pants off Chicagoans before flying south for the winter. And what do you know, like all summer blockbusters, this tale has a sequel. Monty and Rose returned to Montrose to nest again in 2020. Incredibly, they landed in Chicago within hours of each other, despite spending the winter on opposite sides of the Gulf of whatever. The dynamic duo completed the trilogy in 2021, raising a third group of chicks at Montrose. Alas, in 2022, the saga took a tragic turn. Rose never made it back to Chicago, and Monty died of an infection, though some would say it was really of a broken heart. Still, the legacy of these lovebirds lives on, not just in their son, Imani, who's also found a mate at Montrose, but in the goodwill these two crazy kids created for their species. Monty and Rose, putting the love in plover.
And for more on the piping plover nests, you can check out our website at wttw.com/news. One note before we go, you are invited to join us for a WTTW News town hall about police-community relations in Chicago. It's Tuesday, May 26th at 6 p.m. at Thalia Hall in Pilsen. You can reserve your free tickets at wttw.com/events. Tickets are limited, so sign up today. And that is our show for this Monday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.